So we live in difficult times. Of course, maybe every generation says that, but it does seem like we're living in difficult times. It does seem like there's a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty. Our country's still in two wars. There's talk always about Iran. There's terrorism. And there's the economy. Are we in a permanent recession, depression? Or is this just like the 20s? Is this just the United States? Is it worldwide? And then there's climate change. Do you know that, I get my data often mixed up, but something like this, 4 years ago, 65% of Americans believed in climate change, and now it's down to more like 45%. It's less than half people in the United States believe that climate change is going on. Well, that's kind of scary, isn't it? That's scary. So we live in difficult times. There's fear and there's uncertainty all over the place. Trungpa Rinpoche says, hope and fear cannot alter the season. Hope and fear cannot alter the season. Which means that however much hope we have about the future, however much fear we have about climate change or terrorism or whether we're in a worldwide depression, it's not going to alter the season. And so maybe we shouldn't invest so much effort in our fear and in our hope, which is the other side of our fear. Maybe we should invest effort instead in equanimity, in equanimously and calmly accepting things as they are. They've always been screwed up since the beginning of time. Are they really more screwed up now? A huge debate about that, right? Human beings have always been polluting the planet and killing each other. And so, here we are. So that's a lot of what Zen is about, is accepting things as they are, not as we wish them to be, not how could things be other than they are. They're this. But I think it's also important not to be passive about this. This is not passive sort of stoicism. This is not indifference, apathy, and detachment. When we do that, either we're not caring or what? We're repressing. We're walling ourselves off from our fear and our hope. So how can we accept, how can we be equanimous regardless of what's happening? How can we do that? That's the Zen question, but also the Zen practice. The Zen practice. And then we don't invest so much worry about the future or so much hope about the future. Instead, we work from right here, from just this. And we begin to disidentify with our hopes, with our fears, which doesn't mean indifference. Again, it's caring. It's caring without being overly attached to the outcome. That's what it is. So, frequently in my talks, I talk about the Tea Party. Because a lot of my job is working at the legislature. And for years, I had it easy because I had people at the legislature who cared about health and mental health and wanted to spend lots of money on it. I mean, they were not... Well, that sounds bad. No, they felt it was important to spend a certain portion of our resources on it. But then we had a new gang come to town. you guys, but I don't think it was you guys, actually voted in a new gang. And they took over. They took the whole place over. Because we have this, our politics in the United States is that, you know, the majority party just rubs everybody else out, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. And it's getting more and more like that. I guess it wasn't like that so much in Eisenhower's day, but it's like that now. So, in my time over there, and I spent a lot of time over there, although not this time of year, because there's nobody there this time of year. This time of year, I spend trying to get to know the legislators in their businesses or in their communities. But I have two choices, right? I could be frozen in fear that these guys and women with their Bibles in their offices, their Bibles, I talked about that last time, and their American flags, that they will just totally wipe out all the services that many people have developed for folks with mental illness. That's my job. I'm a psychologist, I mostly just promote. I don't work with people individually. I mostly promote. I can be frozen in fear, or I can accept them as they are. They're breathing. they care about their family. They care about each other. They are friendly to me. But I shouldn't get too hopeful about them. If I start getting too hopeful that I can convert them to my way of being, good luck. This is the Tea Party. Remember? Remember, Tim? Best thing to do is... Yeah?
Apparently we don't have a teacher for the intro class upstairs.
Oh. Well, here comes a teacher. All right.
Wow.
What do you know?
They don't know they just learned their first lecture.
Uh-huh. Were they sitting equanimously up there, or were they hoping and fearing? So we always have that choice. We have that choice as human beings. So there's a TV show that used to be on. I actually don't like it, but I happened to watch it a couple times, called Extreme Makeover. Is it still on? Does anybody know? I didn't like it because it was so maudlin and sentimental. But I did watch it once by accident when it wasn't. And... this one was about a guy who was disabled, blind, and quadriplegic. But he had an uncanny musical ability, and he was very bright. And so he figured out a way to work with music and go to college and. He was in the marching band in a wheelchair. It was cool. It was cool. And he said in this show, set your course, but then burn the map. Set your course, but then burn the map. Well, that's a good Zen saying, isn't it? Set your course. You need a course. You need dreams. We all need dreams. We need plans, and they need to resonate from our heart. But then we need to let go of this anxious fear and this clinging hope that we have, and just engage, just completely engage. That's what Zen's about. That's really what Zen's about. So we have a choice, right? We can let these difficult times, these uncertain times, these unpleasant external experiences and internal experiences make us rigidly fearful, make us cling to hope that things will be different. Or we can let them become the basis for us to be more kind, more open, more available to what scares us. So Pema Chodron has three methods for directly relating to our difficult circumstances. The first method is no more struggle. The second is using poison as medicine. And the third is seeing whatever arises as enlightened wisdom. So the first one, no more struggle. Well, so Martin went up to teach meditation instruction down up there, and what he's teaching, probably, because we teach it the same way, is meditation, which is a no more struggle meditation. We're not struggling to get anywhere in our meditation. We're not struggling to accomplish anything. We're coming back to the simplicity and the immediacy of the breath. The simplicity and the immediacy of just breathing again and again and again, again and again and again. We return to the pristine awareness, free from concepts. It may be just this long that it's free from concepts. That's okay. No problem. We stop fighting. We stop struggling to get calm or accomplish something in our meditation. Break through our dark mood or agitated mood in a non-judgmental way. So we touch and go. We touch the feeling, we touch the thought, and we go back to the breath. Touch and go. Touch and go. Touch and go. So that's the first technique for relating directly with the difficulty that we have, rather than wasting our energy on hope and fear. The second is using poison as medicine. And this is one that's big in Tibetan Buddhism and big in Zen, although in Zen we talk about it a little differently than Tibetan Buddhism. But in Tibetan Buddhism, the truism is approach what you find repulsive. Help the ones you think you cannot help and go to places that scare you. And that's fuel for waking up. And specifically, there are forms of meditation for this. There's Tonglen meditation, which we've taught here sometimes. I don't think anybody's taught it lately, but a lot of you have practiced it. Tonglen meditation, where we take in pain. We take in pain and we send out positive energy. And then in Zen, using poison as medicine, we don't say that, but I say the barrier is the gate. The barrier is the gateway. Oh, similar, right? But whatever it is, anything that occurs is being on the path. It's workable because it actually is the path. Our conflicting emotions, our disturbance about what's going on in our community or our world, whatever the barrier is, it shows where we're napping. It shows where we're asleep. And it shows us where we can wake up, which is right here, with whatever it is, without reservations. We make reservations with our hope and fear, but without any reservations. So there's another Tibetan saying, when the world is filled with evil, all mishaps, all difficulties should be transformed into the path of enlightenment. You know, that's Zen too. That's Zen too. So I have a friend named Linda, not my wife, another Linda. And I was talking with her about a couple of months ago after her husband died of cancer. Her husband had been struggling with cancer for, about 4 or 5 years. And he finally died. And she said she was using all of the suffering and the grieving about his death to establish a meditation practice. She'd never had one before. She's, I don't know how old she is, probably 45. She'd never had one. But that suffering brought her to meditation and served as encouragement for her to meditate. And of course, she had to start slowly, especially if you're grieving or if you're in pain. You shouldn't just jump in and do a 7-day retreat. I don't recommend it. But she was starting slowly. She was making the commitment and talked about how she she felt that she could let go of a lot of her worries and concerns, and she already had, even though she was really missing her husband. So those are the two methods, and the third method is seeing whatever arises as wisdom. Whatever arises is a manifestation of this, this awakened energy, this sleeping energy, this energy which is all of us and everything. It's all this. So we don't need to awaken later on, because this energy is pulsing through us. The energy of all life, it's pulsing through everything. It is everything. It's manifesting itself as everything. So this is why Dogen says enlightenment doesn't come later. You engage, and it's practice enlightenment, not practice and then enlightenment, because we are enlightened the moment we engage, because the energy of the whole universe is here. So regarding whatever arises as awakened energy, regarding ourselves with all of our hope and our fear and anxiety and our monkey mind as already awake. Can you do that? It's the same energy, it's the same life, it's the same rhythm, whether it's going 1,000 miles an hour or only 2 miles an hour, isn't it? How could it be different? How could it be different? So, the first, second, and the third, one more time. The first is meditation practice. Training and letting go of the storylines. Slowing down just enough so we could be equanimously present with whatever is. Instead of struggling to make it be different. The second, difficulties as opportunities. In Tonglin, instead of pushing suffering away, we breathe it in and we breathe out the wish that everyone could stop hurting, that everyone could stop hurting, and that everyone could experience contentment. So we transform pain into joy, into quiet joy, quiescent joy, and feel in this suffering a kinship, just a kinship. Kinship with everyone, with everything. But this isn't easy. It's not easy because it's reversing our habitual way of doing things, which is we try to avoid conflict. We try to smooth things out. We try to prove that pain is a mistake that wouldn't exist if only I had done the right thing. If only I had taken better care of myself. I would not have whatever this disease is I have. It's no disease. No disease because nobody knows, right? If only. What a waste these if-onlys are. What a waste. And yet we do it on and on. But this practice is to notice when we're doing it. To notice when we're doing it. And to reverse that habitual pattern. So my friend Linda, whose husband died a couple of months ago, I talked to her on the phone on Friday because she suffered another tragedy early Friday morning at 6:30 a.m. Her daughter, her adult daughter, and this was in one of the papers and on NPR, her adult daughter who suffered from serious and persistent mental illness and has for many years, ran out onto the freeway and lay down and was run over. and so I called Linda as soon as I found out and talked to her. And she's the one who the last 2 months has been really doing this meditation practice to try to deal with her pain. And she said to me, "My, instead of pushing it away, I want to just stay with it. I just want to just stay with it. But it feels so chaotic. It feels so chaotic. I feel so overwhelmed." And then she said, "Will you help me?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'll help you. I'll help you. But the only way I can help you is to just help you breathe into it and breathe out of it, and be with your body and be with your world, and go with whatever happens and not try to anticipate anything different than what is." And so we talked for a while, and she seemed very calm, very calm. But she is going to be grieving for a long time, and she is that will be with her when she meditates. But she has an opportunity just to meet that, just to be with that, and to connect with other people's grieving. We always have that opportunity. And the third one, again, is converting or realizing that the confusion or pain which we use our hope and fear to get away from is just the basic energy of all life. It's the play of wisdom. Wisdom is playing with us. Wisdom is messing us up. Wisdom is just the expression of this. And so one of the techniques that works as part of this attempt just to come back and realize that this is the enlightened world right now is humor. Is humor. And how many of you know about Norman Cousins? Only one of you. Two or three or four of you. So Norman Cousins. So Norman Cousins in the 1960s, he got a really bad disease, and it was supposed to be a fatal disease, and he was in the hospital, and he was not getting any help. He was the editor of Saturday Review, so he was a pretty literate guy. So he checked himself out of the hospital. And he checked himself into a Manhattan hotel suite. He hired a nurse who read humorous stories to him and played Marx Brothers movies for him. And he laughed himself back to wellness. He laughed himself back to wellness. So that's one thing we can do, regardless of how painful our situation is. It's the same basic energy of life. We can see the humor of it, in the humor in it, and laugh ourselves back to just a realization that it's just this. So after that, he recovered and returned to work and wrote about his experimental treatment in his book Anatomy of an Illness. In 1989, it was finally acknowledged in the Journal of the AMA that laughter therapy could help improve the quality of life for patients with chronic illness, and that laughter has an immediate symptom-relieving effect. Hey, what a deal. What a deal. And so we were in study group or something a while ago, a week or 10 days ago, and Ben said, well, what he liked about Zen was that Zen is goofy. He said that was why he was attracted to Zen more than other types of Buddhism. Zen origin is in goofiness, you guys. You think the Marx Brothers have anything over the old Zen teachers? No way. You think Laurel and Hardy have anything over the old Zen teachers? No way. No way. Belly laughs. Belly laughs. Hanshan and Shite. How many of you remember Hanshan and Shite? Laughing outside the monasteries uproariously in early China. Long hair, playing jokes on each other, poking people, falling over. Hanshan and Shite. Early Zen. Early Zen. Putai or Hote. Laughing uproariously with his big bag of oranges as he goes around passing out oranges for to everybody who gives him a penny, but giving the oranges to kids for free. Just having a good time. Belly laughs. He's got a huge belly. And of course, the Chinese value the huge belly in two ways. The Chinese value the large belly. For one thing, it's the hara. So it's the seed of qi. The seed of equanimous energy. But also, the Chinese want to make sure everybody gets plenty to eat. So, it has a dual meaning. So, and then there's this, the talk of the Zen master who bothered everybody in the village down the road from him. He lived a mile up the mountain. And he bothered them with his raucous laughing when the moon came up every night. So the villagers tried to create a way so that he wouldn't have a window in his cabin anymore to see the moon. They said it was time for him to build a new cabin, and they went and built it. Do you know the story? They built it with no windows on the moon side so he wouldn't disturb them with his raucous laughter. So breath moves to the belly in meditation. It moves to the belly when we laugh, too. And we lighten up. We lighten up. It just happens. It just happens. So how about waking up in the morning and dedicating our day to cultivating a sense of humor? And practice giving ourselves a break, okay? Okay, you're plenty dutiful already. Don't add Zen into your extra dutifulness. Give yourself a break. A break means opening. You break, you open. And there's equanimity here when you give yourselves a break, when you open. There's calmness here. That's your true nature. Your still nature. And it's not yours, but it is yours. It's everything's. So every time we sit down to meditate, let's remind ourselves to lighten up. Let's remind ourselves to have a sense of humor. Let's even lower our standards. Lower our standards. Maybe you should say to yourself when you sit down, I'm lowering my standards way down. That's the only way we can relax into what is, right? But then once we take up meditation, we want to do it well. We feel like we're not doing it well. Our mind's getting all agitated. And we're wasting our time. We should be doing something else. Etc., etc. Abandon your standards. Don't just lower them. Abandon them. Can you do that? Just abandon your standards. You can. And then your hara is alive. But don't focus on your heart. Don't focus on your tummy and try to be some sort of breathing guru. Just live. Because then I say this and everybody tries to get their breath in their belly, and then they raise their standards and their breath really isn't in their belly, and so their meditation's not working. Come on. Come on. Forget it. So hope and fear are cool. Human beings have hope and fear. But they're not vitally important. What's vitally important is some confidence in the intrinsic quality of just being, of just being open to what is, to what is. Then we're able to walk on the razor's edge. The razor's edge is sharp and thin, thin. But when we walk on it, we accept life just as it is, fully, and pain comes in. We let it come in. People are dying all over. We're dying inside. Everything that dies gets reborn, and dies and gets reborn. And we accept. We accept. But it's not Tim that accepts. It's not Dan that accepts. It's just equanimous being from... Well, I better not say from the belly, because then you'll try to get into the belly. Forget that. Just from this. Just from this. And then in that equanimity, there's always a quiet joy, even in the middle of pain. There's a quiet composure, even in the middle of heartache, even in the middle of loss of two people I really love in the space of 2 months. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? And then we appreciate the season instead of, and realize that hope and fear can alter, and we don't want them to alter the season even, because the leaves are falling out inside in a beautiful pattern, in a beautiful way, and they'll never quite fall like this again. So that's living. Living in simplicity and openness with what is. So I think that's what I want to say this morning. And I'll be glad to take questions or comments. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Jim. This ties in with your Dharma talk today. My dad passed away last night, and I just noticed that everything has changed, but everything's the same.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to share that with you.
Uh-huh. Do you want to share a little more with us, or is that all you'd like to share? Uh-huh. Well, my heart goes out to you. My heart goes out to you. Other people, other folks. Comments or questions?
My daughter called me last night.
Hi.
Ellen. My daughter called me last night at 11:30.
Uh-huh.
She's a college student.
Uh-huh.
Fretting over the fact that she did not get a text last night from friends about party.
Uh-huh.
And your talk reminded me of what very poor attempted advice I gave her, which was, don't allow others to dictate how you feel about yourself.
Uh-huh.
And as you spoke to this morning, it reminded me of the need that I think all of us have to just accept that some things are just a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And as we, my daughter was fighting last night against them, I was trying to send her as much good thoughts about the need for her to just be settled with the way things are.
Well, good for you.
I appreciate your talk.
Sure. Sure.
Probably send her an email this morning saying about the change, you can't change the season.
Well, thank you. And this is tricky stuff, isn't it? It's tricky stuff. And it sounds like you handle this very well, but often we don't handle this very well. Often we want to give the other person advice, and that's not... When we're giving them advice, we're not helping them be equanimous with the fact that they're feeling pain right now. In most situations. Now, if they ask for advice, but I think our tendency, because we're hopeful, is to think, "Oh, I give some advice." We should be careful about that. I think always very careful. But sounds like you handled it just right.
She probably would agree.
Anybody else?
I have a question.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit more about setting intention and goal setting and how that fits in with accepting how things are?
Yeah. Well, it almost seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? But, and I've talked about this in other talks, but human beings are intention-setting beings. We live in a past, present, and future world. And making plans and having dreams is very important to us. It's nurturing to us. If we don't have dreams and we don't set intentions based on those dreams, we become very, very dry and shriveled up. So that we dream and that we set intentions out of those dreams is something that's very wonderful, very wonderful. But that complements very well just accepting what is. Let me just give an example. I have a dream, and this is just relates to my other job, right? I have a dream that these folks in the Tea Party are still on their case. I'm going to be on their case probably till I get unelected, right? and some of them will, but. I have a dream that they will begin to get that mental illness is nobody's fault. That people with mental illness don't need to just get a job. That people who are homeless aren't just winos. So I have a dream that I really have a dream that I and my friends can show them this. But we can't give them too much advice. We have to bring homeless people to see them. We have to bring people with schizophrenia to talk to them about dealing with schizophrenia. Because if we give them advice, they'll run away. You know, they won't let us in. So that's my dream. But I also have to accept the fact that I don't know if anything's going to happen. But if I really am in love with my dream and it really stay equanimous with my body, I don't have to piss and moan that my dream's not getting realized. It's getting realized in the attempt. Just in the attempt, it's getting realized. Because if I don't change the Tea Party guy, at least I change myself, and I have my friend with schizophrenia who really gets changed because he comes down to the Capitol and tells his story. And that's wonderful. I'm moved. So the dreams are so important. Are so important. But the fixation on the dreams actually shrivels the dreams up, actually puts them in a straitjacket, actually puts them in a guillotine, kind of, because we're not accomplishing. Well, we're not accomplishing, we're not dreaming anymore. If we say, "Oh, I'm not accomplishing. Oh, I can't do this." But we can. Just have to come back. Is that helpful? Okay. Anything more? Okay. Thanks.